Trekkies, welcome to Trek Freaks, part of the Geek Freaks Network. On this podcast, we analyze and review every episode of Star Trek, starting all the way back with the original series. I'm Kevin, and I'm joined by Jonathan.
Well, hello. How's it going, Kevin?
Oh, it's going great. How are you, man?
I'm good. I'm good. Excited for another episode.
Nice. Which one are we talking about today?
Today is the original series, Season 2, Episode 9, Metamorphosis.
Nice. Nice. I like that it's a very clear, decisive name for an episode. You don't have to try to decipher it like Amok Time or any of those. It's just a very clear and concise title. But before we get to the episode, I got a question for you.
All right, shoot.
All right, well, Star Wars has been getting a little bit more popular again lately, a little bit more in my Twitter timeline, at least, with the Obi-Wan Kenobi show going on. So my question is, what Star Wars character would make a good Starfleet captain?
That is a good question. I'm sure a lot of our fans are going to hate you for bringing Star Wars into Star Trek, but
that's fine. I love both, so
yeah,
you know.
I'm sure a lot of fans overlap too. I'm going to have to say Poe Dameron. I know that's not like one of the classic characters from, you know, like Han Solo, people might say, but he's just like a pirate. He's a renegade. He's not reliable as a captain of a, you know, Starfleet crew. But Poe Dameron has like, you know, high morals. Yeah, he's more of a pilot than a captain in his role in the show, but I think he'd make a good Starfleet captain. What about you?
You know, I didn't even think of anything from the sequel trilogy. That's a really good choice, actually. I thought you were going to pick the one that I'm going to go with Obi-Wan Kenobi, just because he's, if you watch Obi-Wan and you watch Strange New Worlds, you'll notice that the characters of Obi-Wan and Captain Pike are very similar. They're the people that have gone away from what they've done for their entire life, and now they're hiding in seclusion, and they get called back to their former life, and they're hesitant, but do it in order to help other people. And that at the core of, you know, being a Starfleet captain is, I think, what makes the best captain is caring for other people. And that's why Pike is really climbing my charts as my favorite Starfleet captain so far.
Yeah, me too. I'm loving this new show. I'm so good so far. I hope they keep it up.
Heck yeah. All right. Well, it is time for the Warp Speed Recap. While escorting a dignitary who has fallen ill back to the Enterprise, the Galileo, along with Kirk, Spock, McCoy, and said dignitary Commissioner Hedford, are captured by a mysterious energy being. Forced to land on a planetoid, the crew meet a man who has been living on the planet for 150 years, and the man is Zefram Cochrane, the inventor of the warp drive. Being held captive by the energy being, known as the Companion, the crew are to keep Cochrane company so that he doesn't die of loneliness. The Companion is able to prevent humans from dying of old age. While learning how to communicate with the being, Kirk discovers that it, or rather she, loves Cochrane. She will do anything to keep him alive. The man must live. Kirk knows how to deal with this, though. Explain how humans need freedom in order to be alive, yada yada yada. The Companion joins herself with the dying Commissioner Hedford in order to better understand human feelings. She lets the crew leave, and Cochrane stays behind to live the rest of his life with his love and her new body. Got kind of creepy there at the end, but there was some good themes in this episode, but also some very kind of cringy, creepy takeaways from it as well.
Doesn't play as well now. I think back in the day, people probably didn't think about it in an uncomfortable way, but yeah, now it's like, okay, he didn't love her until she had this physical body. This physical body doesn't know him.
Right.
And yet now they're going to be like together forever. It's a little interesting, yeah.
Yeah, I think they were going for something more heartfelt than what I got out of it, but we'll get there when we get there. So the episode starts with Spock, McCoy, Kirk, and Commissioner Hedford on board the Galileo, which is the shuttlecraft, the main shuttlecraft that they use so far in the original series and in Strange New Worlds. Commissioner Hedford was taken from negotiations on Epsilon Canaris 2 or 3. I don't remember which. I don't know. It's a random planet that we've never heard of before. because she had contracted some extremely rare disease that was billions to one odds. I was going to ask you at this point, how is there still a disease that's that deadly to humans in, you know, that far in the future? But then the billions to one odds kind of makes it like, yeah, you can't really study something
even
that
then,
you
though,
don't
the
contract.
Billions to one odds. How many humans are living on Earth at this at their time? More than 7 billion, right? I think that's what we have right now, 7 point something. So it's like, okay, so the 7 people on
something
the planet
like that,
you can study right now. So in the future, if it's, you know, 60 billion or whatever, okay, we could pick out the 60 people and put them together and let's figure out what's going on here. But also the transporter technology
right.
does a really good job at eliminating most diseases. So I think that, you know, being able to dematerialize and rematerialize minus the filtered out bad stuff, I think that solves the problem of like a lot of disease, but maybe there's certain ones like this, or like we see in the new episode, or a new episode of Strange New Worlds. There's certain kinds that it just doesn't recognize or whatever. So yeah, there's always going to be limitations to our technology.
Yeah, I hardly ever think of the transporter as something that can cure diseases, but you're right. That is a function of it. Yeah. So that's cool to think about. I always forget about that. Suddenly in the shuttle paths, in the shuttlecraft's path is a mysterious object heading out toward them at warp speed. My typos in my notes are driving me crazy while I'm trying to read. So, there's this big, like, there's an energy being in space that's headed toward them. And of course, as they veer away, the energy being, like, gets in their path, fully envelops the shuttle and shuts down most of its operating systems. I think it keeps life support up, but they can't steer away from it. They can't do anything. And it changes the shuttlecraft's course. I was very hopeful at this point that we weren't going to be retreading, you know, the same ground that we've tread before in Star Trek.
They did a good job, though, at making this not necessarily a god creature, because we see that a million times already, that it's just a god and it can do anything. And this was a little bit more, I think, because of the lack of communication, made this creature more of a creature and less of a god. And, you know, yeah, it could do a lot of things, like keep people alive and make them young, but he can't, like, change matter drastically and stuff like that.
It didn't make a giant green hand in space,
yeah,
like,
catch them,
grab the shellcraft, and then Apollo's head pop up. And,
yeah,
yeah, that was
too much to repeat, at least.
Right. So we get back from the intro, and the shuttlecraft is landed on this planet somewhere next to a cliff. Spock says that the conditions are very similar to Earth, including the atmosphere and the temperature on the planet. At this point, Commissioner Hedford, I think we're supposed to hate her. She's being very impatient and wants to know how long she's going to be, you know, staying put on the shuttlecraft while the others go out and explore.
Yeah, she's very rude and sassy.
Yeah, I kind of got the girl from Willy Wonka.
Oh gosh, yeah.
I want an Oompa Loompa now. Yeah. That's what I got from her.
That's perfect, yeah.
Spock goes to investigate the shuttle, and Kirk asks what's wrong with it. Spock says that it's impossible. Nothing is wrong, yet nothing works. And then we hear screams from a distance. This just immediately took me back to the episode with Lazarus, and I thought I was in for a bad time. As the man approaches, he is surprised to see real people that speak English. He says his name is Cochran, and, you know, if you've seen Star Trek before, you know the name Cochran, and immediately I'm like, oh, that's Zefram Cochran. He's the guy that made the warp drive. His immediate reaction to seeing Hedford, he's just immediately like, oh, it's a woman, and a beautiful woman at
you
that.
You guys have one of those? They still make those?
Right. And then the line, it's food to a starving man to see someone like Hedford.
Why has that got to be so creepy? Can you not?
It was bad.
You could have put a little twinkle in his eyes or something like that and sell it as if he was in love at first sight, not that he was like a rapist who just found a good victim, is what it sounds like, honestly. It's just like, I'm going to take that one from you guys. It's like, no, like, that was just a little too roughly played out.
I think they should have made him like not look as well kept, and because he's been there for 150 years without any other person being there. So he hasn't like spoken to other people in, I would imagine, 150 years. So he kind of doesn't have that filter, I'm guessing. But if they made his like appearance visually like reflect that, it would have, I think, come across less as creepy and more of just he doesn't know what he's saying.
That'd be true. That's true, yeah. It just, I don't know, it came off a little creeper vibes for sure.
Yeah, but we've seen that in Star Trek in the original series quite often, especially with Kirk usually, but Cochrane says that anything that's powered up on the planet, like anything that takes any kind of power, won't work on the planet at all. That includes anything on the shuttle, the their comms, their weapons, none of it will work. And Cochrane invites them all to his home because he's got a little... it's a nice-looking house, even though it's really small. I actually quite liked the design on the outside. Yeah. I don't want it for myself or anything, but it looked pretty good.
He made it from the remnants of his ship, right?
Yeah.
So I wonder if like maybe the energy creature like helped him somehow. I don't know what she or it can or can't do, but yeah, it looks professionally made with the tools that it takes to build, you know, a ship, but looked a little too good to be something he scabbed together, at least.
That's what I was thinking too. Also, he mentions that there's vegetables planted in a garden next to the house. I don't know why there would be vegetables there if there's no life there. True. Or
and also he doesn't age anymore, so I wonder if he still has to eat.
I was wondering that too. Yeah. Like if you're immortal, technically, you can have like any illness and just like feel the effects of it. But once you'd like get to the point where you die from it, you would just not die, right?
Yeah. I guess. I mean, I think like when he merges with the energy creature and they're, you know, interacting or whatever, I would imagine that at that point he's getting like his body's being cleaned. He's getting like nutrients and energy, you know, flowing into him. Any kind of, you know, virus that might be in him or something like that is getting filtered out. Like I imagine that mixing with that energy is probably what keeps him young and healthy, but I don't know.
Okay. That's a good way of thinking about it. Oh, yeah, like, I didn't think
it, like,
about
encompasses
that.
His body when they're communicating at one point.
Yeah. So Hedford is starting to feel the effects of whatever illness that she has that stopped her from her prior job of, what was she doing? She was negotiating peace on a planet,
yeah,
right?
I think like, so.
I kind of want to know what planet it was. I want to see more stories like
and
that.
She was
like,
not a friendly person, so how was she good at that? She didn't seem like a diplomat.
Exactly why I want to see this too. Like, why is it that it had to be her until the end? Kirk makes an offhanded comment about, oh, until they find some other woman to make peace on the planet or something. Right. Okay, so. While they're all talking inside the house, suddenly outside the house, that object appears again. But I would imagine it's much smaller because it's about the size of, you know, a human rather than a shuttlecraft. And Cochrane says that it's just the light playing tricks. I don't know why his immediate reaction was to lie about it.
Yeah.
What do you think about that?
Because eventually they're going to find out about it. So, yeah, I think. He's like afraid of them, how they're going to react, I imagine, because it's a weird alien creature to them and humans' nature is to attack whatever they don't understand. But he knows they're powerless. So I don't know. Maybe he's just trying to earn their trust before he tries to explain his situation a little more.
Yeah, I think he immediately realized he done goofed because he just admits that. The companion on the planet is what saved him. And I think when he crashed there, and I'm pretty sure it's obvious that thing is supposed to be the companion at this point. I don't know if it's supposed to be or not, but that's what I got from it at the time. And it healed him and it made him young. It rejuvenated his body again. And that he is, in fact, Zefram Cochrane, the inventor of what Kirk calls space warp, which I thought was just a little too funny to not put in my notes. Mm-hmm. And he died 150 years ago, but that's when he crash landed on this planet.
Yeah.
As Kirk, sorry.
It's crazy that, you know, this was a cool way to do like a time travel kind of story without actually having time travel. I'm glad that they thought of different ways to do that. You know, they could have been, oh yeah, we went through just some kind of, you know, portal in space or whatever. We got trapped in subspace and then we came back and now we're at a different time. And hey, there's Zefram Cochrane. He just crash landed last week or whatever. this was, I don't know. I like that they diversify their stories and not rinse and repeat, like how this isn't quite a god creature and, you know, it's not a time travel thing too. So it's got a nice different flavor.
Yeah. Absolutely. Kirk and crew are interrogating Cochrane. While they're doing that, the woman's condition is getting a lot worse, and McCoy says that her temperature is reaching 100 degrees and is climbing. Mm-hmm. So she's, whatever illness she has is progressing very quickly to where she's going to be dying pretty soon. Kirk says that Cochrane doesn't look a day over 35, and then when I looked at him and I looked in the mirror, oh shit, I felt so old there.
Yeah.
Oh my god.
I know how you feel.
When I'm watching this episode, I'm like, oh, these guys, they're way older than me, because I remember watching this when I was a kid, and I'm like, no, I'm in my mid-30s too, so I look like that. What is... No, I felt so old. Like, 35 doesn't sound old, but then he looks like an old dude to me, and I'm like, no.
And he's exploring space. What have I done with my life?
Exactly, yeah. He invented a freaking way of people traveling through space.
Yeah.
Kirk asks Cochrane what they were doing there, why they were on the planet to begin with, to which he says they are to keep him company. He told the companion he would die of loneliness, thinking that it would release him. Mm-hmm. Instead, the companion brought company to Cochrane. So I still don't know why originally Cochrane was trying to keep that information from Kirk.
Yeah, that's a good point. I think that's just a plot hole. I don't see any kind of reason for it. I mean, at some point he's going to explain it. I mean, and they could have made it as if Kirk is seeing this creature and Cochrane doesn't realize it. He's in the other room getting them glasses of water, something like that. but then later on he can, you know, explain what's going on. But yeah, for him to see it and then try to cover it up, that just kind of seemed pointless.
Yeah. Hedford did not like that they were to be kept there for eternity. Yeah. Like, she just immediately started going apeshit about it.
I just, while you were talking to, I looked it up because I was like, I know there was more about her, why she was in such a bitter mood. And I realized that, you know, after reading it again. So you're right, she was an ambassador, or, you know, negotiating peace, trying to prevent war from breaking out between these two planets. She got this illness and she blames it on the incompetence of Starfleet Medical, because she should have been decontaminated better or properly or something like that. Yeah, so she's saying, like, pretty much, yeah, she has this disease because Starfleet's incompetence.
Gotcha. That's okay. They were talking about the Starfleet and stuff at the beginning of the episode, and I just totally glossed over that portion of it. Kirk tells Spock to search for a weapon, and they need to leave. Kirk tells Cochrane about all the life and exploration there is in the wider galaxy, so Cochrane agrees to help, to some extent at least. He didn't want to stay there. He thought that the companion was going to release him, so he's all for at least attempting to help Kirk figure out a way to get off the planet. While fixing the shuttle, Spock is visited and attacked by the companion. It also seemingly destroys the shuttle at the same time. So Spock notices it. He turns around and he walked up to the thing, and then it took a second or two for it to actually like attack him, to hurt him. Right.
And it like threw him, right? Like it was like a shock that tossed.
Oh yeah. Flung him back. Yeah. Yeah. And then it started catching all the parts of the shuttlecraft on fire.
Yeah. Yeah. It was all sparking, like it was overloading with electricity or something.
Cochrane attempts to ask the companion for help with Hedford's condition, because Cochrane was able to be, I guess, essentially brought back from near death and rejuvenated to his younger self. maybe Hedford could be healed of whatever disease she's got as well. This was a little cheesy when the when he was calling the companion, it like stayed in the same place on the screen, but they had the camera moving so that it was always in the same spot on the screen as it was going toward Cochran. They didn't do that later on. I think they only did it in this, like, this scene. It seemed a little odd to me.
It's like you're following Mario, like the camera and the character's moving in the landscape. Yeah, it's
right.
A little odd.
It seemed like a good cost-cutting method, but they didn't do it all the other times in the episode. It seemed like it was only in this one scene.
Yeah.
I thought it was a little odd. The companion envelops Cochran completely. McCoy says that it's symbiotic communication. And Kirk says, no, it's love.
Where did he see that? So
yeah.
I think one thing that would have helped this story a lot is we see Cochran has a dedication to this creature because how much, you know, it's done for him. But if they were to tweak that just a little bit to make it look like he actually is confused, but he thinks he loves this creature, even though it's not a human, you know, we could still see love from him to it. And we have no idea how it feels. But then later when it, you know, takes a human form, that would make so much more sense. But right now it's just like he's in service of it. He owes it a debt, but he doesn't necessarily have human emotions for it. And, you know, later on, he agrees to stay once she's in a body. But that's, yeah, I think a little bit of love from him early on would have clarified the ending of it a little bit.
Yeah, I thought that it was a bit of like a Stockholm syndrome situation. Yeah. Like, he was the captive and would do anything to protect the captor. Yeah.
And they could explain that the symbiotic communication thing they're doing is kind of like a mind meld, but instead of just their brains connecting, it's like their spirits are connecting or something like that. And it is a, you know, deep, intimate communication between the two. And because of that, he completely understands, you know, this other creature and vice versa. Yeah, it's a love that humans could never comprehend kind of thing. That would be.
Yeah, and reading between the lines, that's kind of what I got from it, at least. But yeah, like you said, they didn't say any of that at all.
Yeah.
Cochran says that the companion cannot help with Hedford's condition. And Spock determines through being attacked that the companion is made largely of electricity, which I thought was pretty obvious, but maybe that was like the special edition or the remastered version. By looking at it, you could tell, and by the sound effects they were using. Yeah. But I guess it's good to have some things just said in plain English. A device is made to scramble the companion's electrical impulses. Cochran says that he doesn't want to kill the companion, but Kirk says he will do anything to save them all. So Cochran reluctantly offers to bait the companion in. I still don't know Cochran's motivations at this point. Like, he seems willing to help Kirk. He says he's willing to help Kirk, but he's also trying to go out of his way to protect the companion.
And I imagine he's going to like try to help them get off the planet, but he would in the end like give them a push and stay behind and stay with the companion. But at least, you know, he's able to interact with humans and help them, you know, get to their normal lives. But yeah, I don't see him betraying the companion and leaving with them if that was even an option.
Right. But he also said that he wanted to leave, too. So, I don't know.
Yeah, and I wonder how his aging would return. Would he just start aging from that day on? Or would he catch back up to 150 years older?
Right. Oh, man, that would be freaky. Yeah. Like, going from 35 to, you know, 185 or whatever, just instantly.
Yeah, like if he gets a routine treatment from her every, you know, 4 hours, but he doesn't get that. Maybe after an extra couple hours, you start to see he's already like 20 years older, 30 years older, and like he's increasingly aging rapidly without, you know, interacting with this creature.
There once again was an episode of Stargate SG-1 that did something very, very similar to what you just said.
Nice. Gotta get.
So after.
Oh, I bought the DVDs of that too, of the first two seasons, I think. I haven't sat down to watch them yet, but I'm going to at some point, I promise.
Nice. It's also all on Netflix. After Cochran baits the companion in, they do their whole symbiotic communication thing. Spock turns the device on. And Cochrane immediately collapses, and the companion takes out the device and attacks Kirk and Spock. It just, like, flicked a switch in it, and it was like, nope, this ain't happening. Went right after them. Man, messed their shit up. McCoy, seeing this from the other room, pleads for it to let them go. And Cochrane ends up standing back up and then calling the companion back. And the companion, like, changes back to its softer tone, softer color. It's like a yellowish rather than the evil-looking red that it was when it was attacking. And starts communicating with Cochrane again. Yeah, so how... this isn't a question that I'm, like, necessarily writing to ask you, but I'm going to say, how do you fight something like that? That's what they're talking about.
I got it.
How do you fight something like that,
I got
though?
An answer, though. In their ship, they need to disassemble their ship, right? They must have devices that manipulate electricity, especially capacitors. They hold the charge. So if you can daisy chain all the capacitors you can get out of the ship and you connect them to this alien, it should absorb a portion or as much as possible of the energy from it, since it's electric based, or try to ground it if you can ground it.
That makes good sense. That makes sense. My brain's weird today, but yeah, I like that. I couldn't think of anything. There's always technobabble stuff that you could think of or write in to make anything make sense. Yeah. Like, but yeah, I'd have no idea. But McCoy suggests using a carrot instead of a stick. So trying the diplomatic approach, I suppose. So Kirk tells Spock that he is to update the universal translator to be able to communicate with a companion, which you would think with, I've been wrong about their motivations before, but you would think with Kirk, that would have been the first go-to, would be trying to communicate rather than trying to annihilate.
Yeah, and usually we see that. Usually, well, I don't know, usually in other series, maybe not so much with Kirk, but yeah, most of the time they try to communicate first, figure out, you know, what the other person's motivations are, and make sure there's not, like, some misunderstanding between them, and then last resort is to attack and, or, you know, fight to defend themselves. But
Right. You know, prime directive
exactly.
Shit. on the ship, finally on the ship, this is the first time we see the Enterprise this whole episode. Scotty is giving his version of the captain's log, acting captain's log. He says that Kirk and Kirk and his party are late for the rendezvous, so the Enterprise is out searching for them. And when I said before that I would choose Scotty as my first officer in a question at the beginning of an episode, mm-hmm. this kind of proves to me that I made a good choice, because he's very calm and collected right here. He knows that he's on the right path. And even with Uhura and Sulu kind of questioning, well, how do you know we're doing the right thing? He's like, oh, we're doing what we need to be doing. This is right. We're good. We're going to find them. He's a good acting captain.
And I think he's a good kind of by the book guy. He's a good balance between Kirk and Spock, because I feel like he knows,
yeah.
you know, what's the logical way to do it, or what is his training telling him to do. But when it's a matter of emotion, like, no, we have to go that extra mile to save this life, he'll go that extra mile. So pretty cool.
Spock is done modifying the universal translator, and my first thought was that it was maybe what Star Wars used to base the lightsaber off of.
Yeah.
Because it looked exactly like Kirk was holding a lightsaber.
And so the universal translators don't, like, automatically update when they interact with other aliens?
The lore is a little iffy at this time.
Universal translators in general are not clear, like, how they operate. Because there's a lot of times where an alien will be speaking English and then they say a word that, you know, they say from their native tongue or whatever. And it's like, well, that shouldn't be a challenge. Or they meet a people that just don't, they're trying to speak English, but it's not very clear. And, like, if you could speak English and you can't speak it clear, the universal translator should clear it up for you, right?
You would think,
but,
yeah.
I don't know.
And that's the kind of little stuff that I try not to pay too much attention to. That and, like, how if what they're saying is being translated, why are their lips moving as if they're saying it in English? This is like little stuff like that. It doesn't really matter.
One thing I heard that helped a lot for me was that when people are focusing, if they want to say something in their native tongue and it not be translated, they have to focus on that word a little bit harder and it will come out their word. So if it's a name of a shuttlecraft or something like that in their language, you know, then they'll just have to say it with more, not so casually, and it won't get translated. So I don't know. Maybe there's more cues. So
we do hear, The Next Generation, we hear a lot of Klingon words, and it's like mixed in. Like, Worf is talking in, I would imagine, it sounds like he's talking in English. It could be just being translated through the Universal Translator, but then he'll say something in Klingon, like you're saying, and it just comes out as a Klingon word, even though it's supposed to have been translated. Yeah. So that
you
does
call
help
somebody
a little
Patak,
bit.
You don't want that to be translated.
Exactly. Nice. Cochrane again calls the companion, and Kirk begins to talk. The companion understands what Kirk is saying. It is apparently female, and it's not a zookeeper. Rather, it's Cochrane's lover, is what is being gathered by what's happening here, which makes the whole thing, it makes it a little sad, but it makes it also very awkward.
Yeah, he's willing to, at least from their perspective, kill his lover to help himself and the rest of them escape the planet. And I just don't think, I mean, we should have seen a little bit more of love from his perspective, though.
Yes,
I agree. He might be going crazy because he's been there 150 years, but we don't see that, too. We don't see that, like, at least a mention that, yeah, his mind, Spock could say his mind doesn't seem quite stable because of his, you know, duration of, you know, separation from humanity or something like that. But yeah, we should see that he loves this creature so much and that he's willing to kind of trick it to help them get free, but he's not going to hurt it to benefit himself or them, you know, something like that.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree completely with that. Like, you would think that if it's love and that the companion character, whatever, feels it, that he would have had to have been showing it back to her. It would have had to have been reciprocated, right? But Cochrane acts like it's a total surprise. He's totally shocked that he's not just I don't know. He even calls it the companion, so I don't know what he's expecting here.
And this, like, melding they do, this merge, you know, you would think if that's them communicating, it's more than just words. It's a emotional, mental, psychological, like, it's full connection, so they should understand each other's, you know, interests and motives and stuff like that very clearly. Maybe not. Right. Maybe it's like holding hands and it just looks like it's a better merch. I don't know.
The companion doesn't understand that the lack of harm and unlimited life isn't truly living. This is what Kirk is trying to explain to her, that it's not really life if you're in a cage. It's, you know, it's all the those episodes we've seen, I think, 3 or 4 times from the original series at this point. I think they're trying to rush that part along. That's why they kind of did it toward the end of the episode. It's like, yeah, they've seen this before. That's not really what this episode's about. So it was just it was Kirk's go-to. Life isn't worth living without obstacles and whatnot. The guys explain to Cochrane how the companion loves him, and he's just not into it, like I was saying. I don't know. Like, I really don't know what he was expecting. It's so strange to me, but...
Yeah, and I don't know. I know we'll go into it here in a minute, but, like, once she takes human form, if they're madly in love, like, and everything, that's great, but she's in human form. You guys can all go together now with the Enterprise. Why would you stay behind? I don't know. It just doesn't, because she loses her, like, control, like, her power, right? By taking human form, she's no longer that energy entity. I don't know. I'm sorry. I know I'm jumping ahead already, though. We can get to that.
Just a little bit, but yeah. I just don't understand why. Even Cochrane says he might be 150 years out of style, but he's not going to allow it to continue the way it's going. Like, he's trying to say that I know my way might not be the right way, but this isn't love because it's not a woman, is essentially what he's saying.
Like, you spent 150 years with this creature. If you spent 150 years with a dog, you're going to be madly in love with that dog. Not that you're going to try to, you know, make puppies or nothing, but you can still be in love with, you know, another living thing, and, you know, you go through the same kind of remorse when it dies or if it gets lost, or you're willing to sacrifice your own life to save it. Like, that's, you know, love in some degree. So,
yeah.
I don't know.
We cut over to Hedford, who is talking about her imminent mortality, like her imminent death. She doesn't want to die. She says that she is really good at her job, but she's never been loved, which is setting up what is to come. She's upset that Cochran is running from something that she's never had, which I thought was a good little bit of character work that didn't really need for this character at this point in her arc because she's about to die. But I kind of wish they'd explained or like extrapolated on that a little bit earlier in the episode to make the whole dynamic of Cochran not accepting love a little bit harder, in the beginning,
when they're in the shuttle and they're coming down. Bones could have been just trying to get to know her a little bit or something like that and ask, you know, hey, so is there a Mr. Cochran or Mr. not Cochran, Mr. Hanford? And, you know, then she'd be like, oh, you know, actually, you know, never found the time. I've always been too busy to get into a serious relationship, something like that. And then, later on, now she would show the remorse for that and really explains reasons why or something. But
cutting back to the Enterprise, they're approaching an asteroid belt and they're going to start scanning for life forms, asteroid by asteroid, planetoid by planetoid, trying to find their missing crew. Uhura, she's not really a fan of this method. She's said it'll take so long. How are we ever going to find them? And once again, Scotty's like, we'll do our job. We'll scan each one at a time. We're going to find our people. Kirk again tries to explain the situation to the companion, but she still isn't understanding the whole living free, dying hard situation, like the comparison between life and, you know, living free, I suppose. This is when Kirk actually says, and it's a good line, I think he's probably used it before, but he says that we live to overcome obstacles, and without those obstacles, we weaken, and then we die. I thought was a very simplistic way of putting it, so even in a being of energy would be able to comprehend what he was trying to get at. Cochran says that they cannot love each other, that they're too different, and that she must let him... Oh, wait. No. Was that Kirk that says that? I just said he in my notes. I'm guessing it's Kirk. Kirk says that they cannot love each other, that they're too different, and she must let them all go. No, that's got to be Cochran. That's Cochran. Yeah, that's Cochran. Yeah. Cochran says they cannot love each other, that they're too different, and that she must let them all go.
I still don't get that. With this connection he's had 150 years, even if they can't communicate, you know, you'd think you would build that connection and understand that you could love this creature. But I don't know.
Right.
But unless he has felt like a prisoner for 150 years, that would be very different. But if he has that kind of companionship with her, then you would think that would only naturally lead to some kind of even a respectful love, not necessarily like romantic.
I kind of wish I understood his motivations a little bit more in this episode.
Good episode, but it's a little unclear.
The companion suggests that if she were human, there could be love. And it's pretty apparent what's going to be happening when she says that, because there's someone who is a human who's not about to be alive anymore that has never been loved. And I think if they would have built up to that rather than having all of that exposition all at once, it might have made a little bit more of an impact. Suddenly we see Hedford. She is with the companion. They're joined, is how the companion explains it. Bone says that Hedford's completely healed. I don't know if there's much of a precedent in Star Trek for, at this point, before the Trill, I should say, of two beings inhabiting one body and living together, you know?
And they don't kind of explain, like, how are those two entities going to be sharing the same body? But did it show her actually dying, Hedford? die, and then she was embodied by the alien, or no?
No, she was very close to death, and the companion went into her body and then healed the body right before she died.
If there wasn't so much build up to this, if it wasn't so obvious what their plan was, then it would have been interesting to see Hedford died kind of quickly, and we didn't even think that this creature could heal her or something like that. And so after that, then it's like a surprise, you know, she's revived by this creature only. You know, it's like a Hail Mary. Like maybe Cochran has to plea with the alien. Like, is there anything you can do to save her? And she's like, I can, but I have to sacrifice myself to do it. And then they become one. And even the alien maybe doesn't know this is going to keep itself alive. It thinks, yeah, I'm going to die to bring her to life. And then sure enough, they actually can both live in one body. I think that would have been a little more, I don't know, climactic end of the story.
Yeah, I don't know if Star Trek's at this point has really cared about pacing when it comes to storytelling. Yeah. They just want to get their message across, which is what bugs me the most. And I think that's what we rip into the most about these episodes.
We were talking about how like they have like maybe 2 weeks to put this whole thing together because they're doing them like on top of each other. But these episodes come out, you know, every week, and they have an hour long episode with a lot to put in there. No real CGI budget or ability. So this is, you know, labor intensive shows. I understand there's a lot that they can't fit in these episodes.
Speaking of just not understanding character motivations, Cochran's scared. Okay, that's understandable. Cochran's scared that the companion kind of... I'm going to say that she, like, absorbed the commissioner at this point. Like, that's basically what happened. But he's taken aback, and the companion starts feeling loneliness for the first time because she has some connection to human emotion now, because they're... I guess what I don't understand about this whole commissioner companion thing is, are they still like two beings within one, or are they now just one new, or are they two things?
Yeah, exactly. That's a perfect example. And I think they want us to believe that it's like a Tuvix, where they're completely merged and there's not two psyches fighting for control of the one body, but they're just joined together. But then it's like, okay, maybe this alien was madly in love with Cochran, but this commissioner had no interest in him, never met him before today. So I was like, why is she? She's like, thanks for keeping me alive, but now I want to go back to doing my job. That's just kind of odd.
We kind of see that with the Trill later on in Star Trek, where if the host dies, the symbiote, the symbiont is what they're called, when it gets implanted into a new host body, they're not even allowed to contact or to be in like relationships with prior hosts, significant others and stuff, because those emotions between host and symbiont get too mixed up and it gets complicated and messy. She says that they're all free to leave now, though. So all it took was for her to be, you know, to feel human emotion for the first time, to realize, oh shit, this sucks. I've been doing this wrong for 150 years. Right. I'm sorry. You can go now.
And now she is a fitting companion. She's a, you know, a friend for Cochran. So he won't feel or shouldn't feel loneliness unless he hates her. But, you know, now he doesn't need other humans around because he has her as a human to keep him company.
Well, that's where I was getting at with I'm not understanding the character motivations, because Cochran says that he's scared, but then immediately looks at her and goes, oh, you're so beautiful. And I guess in those times, that's all it takes to get over 150 years of captivity. Yeah. Like, where are you coming from, dude? Like, pick a lane, I guess? Like,
I don't know. That's true. That was just kind of an odd scenario. I don't know. I don't know how to make it any better. I mean, we've talked about a lot of different ways, but at that point, it's like, he liked the pretty lady who was sick and dying, but then this alien goes into her. You would think, yeah, he doesn't know her, doesn't trust her, doesn't understand her motivations. And it's like, okay, well, we're going to be together forever and you guys can just go ahead and go on your way. Like, what? No. And even at that point, like, okay, you have a starship there. This alien is now made human. So why don't you guys go with them and be with other humans and experience life? at that, because I'm pretty sure at that point she can no longer keep him young. So they're just going to live and live, grow old and die. So go see what happened with your technology over the last 150 years.
Well, see, that's the thing is, she says that she can't leave the planet.
Oh, okay.
And I don't know why that is. Like, I'm guessing because she's still part energy being or whatever, that she's, like, still tied to that planet. She can't leave that planet.
Yeah, it must be. Maybe, like, what's her name? Ego from Guardians of the Galaxy?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I gotcha. Hold on, I skipped over this one part. This was kind of nice. I like this. When Cochrane is talking to the companion, she lifts up like a piece of her clothing to like look through to see him, and the clothing, like the fabric, has the same sort of pattern on it that the energy that she had before had. So it was like she was looking at him through her old eyes before taking her human form, and I thought that was kind of cute. It was.
Yeah, it's like a kind of polka dotted, or not even that, like tie-dye scarf that she has. And then you realize, like, oh yeah, this whole time she's been wearing that. I wonder if that was like pre-laid kind of symbolism that these two are going to be one, or, you know, relating the two at least.
Yeah, I didn't even think of that. I was just thinking how cute she's looking at him the way that she used to, like with obscured vision. And so, yeah, I don't know. Cochrane wants to leave at first. But then just immediately is like, yeah, I'm not going to leave. I'm here. I'm going to stay with her. And then they're going to grow old together and die now, because while she can't leave the planet because she's part energy being, she doesn't have any of her powers to keep them alive still. I don't know why they wouldn't explain that a little bit.
You think at this point for him to stay behind was just dedication or devotion to her, not necessarily like a romantic love, but because she took care of him for 150 years? I don't know.
I guess, like, he owed her something.
And I think he'd be happy to fall in love. Like, he was so excited to see the commissioner. But
that's
though. Yeah, he's with this alien creature. And they were able to communicate to some extent for 150 years. So it seems like he would already have developed some kind of, you know, affection for her, even if he understands, yeah, she's not human. We can never love each other the same way as I could a human person. But I don't know. A little odd.
It's just weird how it's kind of a love triangle with two people.
I think that's what it is.
Yeah, the companion loves Cochrane. Cochrane wants the commissioner. And the commissioner just wants to be loved in general.
Yeah, she just wants to live. But yeah, and to be loved.
Yeah. And then right at the end, right before it cuts, Cochrane tells Kirk to not tell anybody about him. Why? Like, why does it matter? Like, does he just want to live out the rest of his life in seclusion? Like,
I'm pretty sure Starfleet will be there right away with, like, a science team to study him or something like that.
Yeah, it's still, like, maybe after he dies, be like, okay, make a report of this and let people know how I actually died. Yeah. But it just seems like he's ashamed of his choice. It's what it almost, like, don't tell anybody that I chose to live with this energy being only after she took the form of this beautiful woman.
Well, what's Kirk's report of the commissioner going to say? She died and we left her body on the planet?
Yeah, no shit, right? How are they going to explain that?
That was a crash landing.
I must be that Starfleet medical again. Just doing...
Hopefully we didn't catch that disease.
Oh man. Well, that's the episode. It was a good episode. It kept a solid pacing while not having story pacing, I suppose, that I would have liked from it, but it was still a solid episode. Did you get any moral from the story?
Yeah, more or less like how we kept talking about Cochrane didn't really love that creature until she was in a human form and whatnot. So it's just love doesn't have to look normal, I guess. Like, you can love somebody that's not your same race or, you know, color or species or hair type or whatever, even if your parents don't like them or something like that. Like, you know, just try to keep it healthy and safe. But love doesn't have to fit in the usual, you know, restraints.
That's a good way of putting it. That's essentially what I got from it too. Love is love. While the episode's way of explaining that's kind of outdated, that's what I got from the episode. you can fall in love with anyone, and it's perfectly natural, normal, and healthy to do that. So, just, yeah, love is love. What grade would you give the episode?
It was a pretty good episode. The story just needed some tweaking, I think, and the way the characters portrayed their emotions. So I'd probably say like a B+.
Okay. I actually had a B+ at first, and then I was like, I don't know. Some of the character motivations were a little too iffy for me. So I give it a B. It was not a boring episode. Like most times when I'm taking, especially when I'm taking notes to do one of these episodes, I end up pausing it all the time, taking breaks. This one I didn't. I just watched it in one sitting and took notes while it was going, and it was very smooth and it kept me entertained. Most of it taking place off the ship was pretty nice, too. I like that. They had different sets.
Yeah, and the sets looked pretty good. Like, but I don't think this was just styrofoam on stage. I think they had to go out to, you know, the desert somewhere. So, I don't know. So at least some of it looked like it was outdoors.
There was some creepiness in the episode that kind of held it back a little bit, too. But, yeah, in the late 60s, I'm sure it wasn't as creepy as some of the parts were.
Think of your grandpa's jokes. Those would fit in this time. So, yeah.
Well, next week, Jonathan and a special guest are going to be talking about season 2, episode 10, Journey to, is it Babel or Babel?
Babel. Yeah, it's a really good episode, Babel. Too. You guys got to tune in for that one.
Nice. All of our social media links are below. Hit us up on Twitter, Instagram. We're on Twitch. We stream on Twitch. Maybe not so much with the Star Trek stuff, but Geek Freaks in general. All of us hang out on Discord, though, pretty frequently. So if you want to chat with us about anything Star Trek, just do so. We love talking nerdy with you guys, so that's a good way to do it. And if you've enjoyed the episode, make sure to leave a review on Apple Podcasts. It helps us get out there to more people, the more listeners, so that we can spread the love of Star Trek with more people. And until next time, Transporter Room, 2 to beam up.